First question. We've been married for just a year. What is one thing, looking back on your marriage, that you would encourage people, that you would have liked to have done, or knowing, looking back on marriage?
First year of marriage, what one thing would we do to encourage someone else?
Yeah.
Read it one more time, John.
We've been married for 1 year. What is something you wish you'd known or started doing earlier in marriage?
Okay, what would we have wished we would have done earlier in our marriage or encourage you to do? Go.
I think we stumbled across it was finding that couple that was a little bit older, 4 years ahead of us. Because I think that was the defining pivotal moment when we met Gary and Karen. Because we didn't know what we didn't know. And this was a couple. They weren't like, you know, as old as us, but they were just 4 years down the road. They had fun together. They loved the Lord. They were involved in the local church, which, you know, was important to us at that time. We didn't, again, we weren't like super spiritual. We were just part of a local church and trying to grow as Christians. And we loved Jesus and wanted to have a good marriage. So I would say finding that couple.
I have a couple things. Write the mission statement. Start on your mission statement. I think that I can't undervalue that, how important that is for you. I think that's the first thing. I think the second thing is continue to date each other. You know, you think, gosh, now that we're married, we don't have to date. And, you know, set a night aside. I've got to say I'm really proud of my daughters and their husbands and that they have done that. They've set a night aside because, you know, it's so easy to get involved in really good things. Whether it's evening Bible studies or it's hanging out with friends or, you know, some other kind of ministry that you do or work commitments. I know you work very long hours in the D.C. area, so find a night, a Thursday night or something, and that becomes a non-negotiable night that the two of you spend together. You don't have to go out. It may be that you keep the TV off and you make a nice dinner and just spend time together. It might be that you make a nice dinner and then have some movie you've been dying to watch, and so you decide to watch a movie that evening. But you don't want that to be your regular. But something that you do that's just the two of you every week.
We cooked together a lot. We didn't have any money, and so we did a lot of cooking. And one of the things we discovered later in marriage was someone said when you start to drift in your marriage, go back to what you did when you were dating and early married. Something about, I don't know, imprinting maybe. And so she's still, probably one of the most romantic things for Cindy is if I go in the kitchen and we cook together. Mm-hmm. Go figure. I hate washing dishes, and so she'll do that, and we'll make stuff up and cook. And it's still one of the highlights, so just go grab something at the grocery store, make it up as we go. And we spend a lot of time with a little music on, TV off, and cooking a meal together. And we did that in our first year of marriage a lot and returned to that.
Cindy, you mentioned the mission statement. Can you share with us what your all's mission statement is?
I don't know that I can.
it's kind of long. I can send it to you, but one reason we hesitate to share that is we want folks to develop their own. Because if you see someone else, you go, oh, let's do that, and there's no ownership.
Any principles to consider?
Well, I would say start obviously at the horizontal, I mean, at the baseline, your personal walk with Christ. I've talked about that many times, your walk with Christ. Secondly, what do you want to accomplish in your marriage? What are some specific things you want to accomplish in your marriage? And one thing for us at this chapter is our ministry going forward. What does marriage ministry look like now? We continue to do the marriage mentor groups, but we've been asked on this trip up here, what are we doing next chapter? We have this, we call it the proverbial walk on the beach, where when we used to go to this conference each year, we would have to take this, you know, trip we didn't want to do, but we had to for our job. And we would go to a beach. I'm not a beach guy. Fair-skinned people don't do well on beaches. So we go up for, well, we got to take a walk on the beach. And I would ask the questions. Looking back on this year, what was good, what was bad? Looking ahead, what do we want to do next year? And this just became a habit for us. It's almost like when we get in the car, we go Pavlovian. If we're going on a trip, what are we doing right now? And we're constantly asking that question. And I would put some of the burden of this in the man's lap. Because leadership to me is initiation, not telling. It's asking questions. Honey, what do you think about this? So this would be a real good application to go home and say, honey, what would a mission statement look like in our marriage, in our personal life with Christ, in parenting our kids? And what do we want those kids to be? We try to have our kids be lights in their context. That when you're public school or wherever, you're a Christian in that context. It's tough today.
And you don't want to, you know, have your mission statement. You say, it can be bullet points, but you don't want to have like we're going to teach our children these 25 things. Pick three. Just three things that
less
you really want your home to represent, that you want your kids to be able to walk out and to know what those three things are, or for you as well. You know, you want to look at what impact do you want to have on your community. And I'm not talking about all of Nova. I'm talking about your neighborhood, your street, your next-door neighbor. I mean, it doesn't have to be big. What are some things you want to do? Another thing that Michael talked about, the goals. But we would go, what do we want for 5 years and 10 years? What do we want our life to look like? And everything from what kind of a house do we want to own, so that... And all of this changed. It changed all the time. But it was so that we had a comprehension of, you know, gosh, we want the biggest mansion there is. No. I mean, we would say, we want a home that's comfortable, that's warm, that has, you know, three bedrooms or four bedrooms for all of our children, or whatever it is.
That's what she wants.
Yeah. Something that
I want them to stay in the hotel. Go forth.
Yeah. But just something that... that you have something to look forward to. And you might even write those down. Again, it's not the, oh my gosh, we didn't make this goal in 5 years. It's, you'll more laugh at them. Can you believe we wanted that? What were we thinking? You know, but it's just a good thing to kind of keep you grounded and to make sure that you're not being pulled in directions that you don't want to be pulled.
Okay, so I have several questions here, but let me just take a moment and see if there's a question from the crowd. Okay, gentleman over there.
I don't think it's helped at all. I don't think it's helped at all. And Cindy and I have the same problem, and we both live on it. We've instituted a thing at our church right now, and on meetings, you put it in the basket or you leave it in your office. You don't bring it to the meeting. And I live on the calendar mostly. That's why I have my device, but nevertheless, it communicates something. And we were out to dinner last night, and she was doing a little work with a client, and so I'm looking at an email. You know, and it's There's some neuroscience stuff going on with technology, too, that's pretty frightening if any of you read in the neuroplasticity, neuroscientific realm, and it's actually deadening us. I think a lot of the pornography addictions are going to have long-term consequences because of technology. So I would say when we're home, because as a realtor, her job is worse than a pastor. It never stops. You can't tell a client, I'll talk to you Wednesday. The house is gone in our world. So it's an area we fight with, and candidly, I love it. I love the freedom of it. I mean, we were doing something today, and said, well, what was this? And we Google, what is this? And it tells you. I mean, it's crazy, right? What's it going to be? It's going to be USB 7. They're going to plug it in our head in about 2 years. You won't even have to have a phone.
The one good thing is that we can do a family text and everybody gets it.
That's the one good thing. Yeah,
I love that. I mean, that's just like, you know, hey, y'all want to come up for dinner? And, you know, in 2 or 3 minutes, I get answers from everybody. And what are you bringing? Because I'm not cooking, you know.
There is some literature out there. I've not read it recently. I read articles and abstracts mostly, but there's some books that are coming out on, especially children and cell phones, that you younger parents need to be learning.
Yeah, vigilant, I would say.
Anyone else here? Or will you think here for a second? Because I got some more. How do you resolve conflict in marriage? For example, we have disagreements in raising or disciplining our kids. Others have stated financial matters, or even things like when and where to take a vacation.
Great questions. I grew up never going on vacations. Cindy was a family of five, and they went everywhere on vacation. And so that was a big fight in our early years of marriage. And because I felt like I had to do everything. I had to plan it all. I had to organize it all. I had to drive the car. In those days, I was a mechanic because we didn't have, you know, good cars, and I was a guy that could push wrenches, so I was always worried about the car's going to break down, and it did. So vacations to me were not pleasant, and you had to work on me on that.
Yeah, because I just thought we should go away and have fun, and especially as we began having children, I wanted to create things that gave them memories and take them to parts of the country they weren't ever going to live in and get to see, So I think for the most part, we've only had one truly disastrous vacation with our children that they now laugh about it and mock us. But other than that,
I'm still bitter.
What we've found is that, the question was conflict, not vacations. Why are we on this? Let me tell you about conflict.
About planning a vacation.
Yes, how to deal with conflicts.
Good. See, that's why she's smart.
One of the things that I adopted, not real early in our marriage. I don't remember how many years I was married, but I was studying the Book of Esther, and Esther hears from Mordecai that the Jews are all going to be killed, and he entreats her to go to the king, and at first she's afraid, and then finally she mans up, so to speak, and says, okay, if I die, I die, for such a time as this, blah, 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 okay.
That's a paraphrase.
But in reading that, it hit me that Esther spent 3 days preparing to go talk to her husband. Thinking, praying, having others pray. Now, not that I call everybody I'm having conflict with Michael pray for 3 days. I don't do that. But I started, if there was something really bothering me, I started taking 3 days to pray about it, to think through it, and then to go to Michael. It does a couple things. He knows that if I've thought about something for 3 days, it's really important to me, that we really need to, I need his full attention. I need him to hear me. That's the first thing. The second thing is sometimes after 3 days, the issue is already resolved or it's not an issue anymore to me. Sometimes I was just PMSing and I was just mad. It didn't matter that he was like kind of in the way. He got my anger. So sometimes, I realize it's just not that big of a deal. But it's really been good. Now, I've met women who are going, I could never wait for 3 days. And I'm like, well, you know what? That's an area of discipline then. That maybe you need to learn to wait 3 days. Maybe you're running too fast to state your case. And so just give it a little time. So that's one thing that I think has really helped, is that he knows when I say, honey, I need to talk to you about this. Or, and the other thing is we pick our times carefully when we discuss conflict. It might be, hey, there's something I need to talk to you about what looks good on your calendar. And we literally set an appointment to talk through a conflict. That does two things. It removes your emotion from your conflict. Now, it can come right back when you start talking about it, but hopefully it's at least 3 days later and you've got that under control. But it gives us a chance to not deal with it immediately. We don't, during those days, we don't cold shoulder each other. We can somehow compartmentalize, where we can still have an issue between us, but we know we're on the same page. Again, it's back to Michael saying, you hold the problem out here and not in front of your hearts. So, this is the problem, and in 3 days, we're going to attack this and see how we can figure it out.
But budgeting, I would say, you need a budget, especially in your early years. You need to sit down and do it. And for 3 months, you know how to do this. You keep every receipt, everything. If you buy a bottle of water, if you fill up gas, if you pick up dry cleaning, if you get your nails done, you keep a receipt for every purchase you make for 3 months, and you can put it. Now they got, is it Mint, the one that's all online?
Yeah, that's cool.
If you don't do old school. And you look at where your money goes. If you ever listen to Ramsey, he goes, you name every dollar. That dollar has a name. That dollar goes for manicures. That dollar goes for mortgage. That dollar goes for giving, whatever you name that dollar. A budget is a freeing tool, not a controlling tool. Now, if you're the spender, if you're the one that doesn't want a budget, you need to submit to the process to say, it's good for our marriage to manage our money. And investing, especially in your early years, you've seen these studies. If you fully invest your IRAs and so forth in your 20s, even at low interest rates, you'll have $1 million in your IRA when you retire. But you got to start in your 20s. You can't catch up. And so you need help to do that. We now have a financial person we go to that has been remarkably helpful. We've sent both our young kids to him. Said, go sit with these guys and just map out a strategy and have someone else take the conflict out of it. And find an encouraging planner that can say, okay, this is your mortgage, these are your requirements, probably have student loans, whatever you got. You're going to do something for a college savings plan, if you're going to put some money aside for your kids. And get some help with that. That is a contentious area in marriage, no question. And I think we were too scared, really, to worry about fighting over money. We both understood the power of money, and we needed help. And so after that first probably 3 years of marriage, I don't think we ever really argued about money, but we set the template. And that lunch money, metaphorically, was you can blow it on what you want. She can blow it on her hobbies. I got a friend, his wife's a quilter like crazy. She spends her money on quilting stuff. He's got his lunch money to do what he wants, and they don't argue about it. Because once you put it on paper, we've removed it over here. That's our budget. We've agreed to it. And then you reevaluate. You're not chained to it. 4 months from now, it ain't working. Let's go back and take another look at our budget. Where's the money going? Oh, we forgot. We got to pay insurance every 6 months. We didn't anticipate medical expenses. And little by little, you build. Don't be discouraged on money, because money is a building block.
Michael, well, what happens if you have gotten into an argument and you've gotten angry at your spouse, and maybe you said some things that you wish you hadn't said, and now you're in the after moment? How do you deal with that sort of conflict, Michelson?
Well, if you have just said words that hurt, immediately apologize. Immediately apologize and stop doing it. You need to really make the decision, and you have to do it before conflict, before the next conflict, that you will not say words that hurt. Period. You're not going to call names. You're not going to cuss. You're not going to say words that hurt. Because as you all know, words never go away. They're there forever. They're in that heart and the mind of the person that you aim them at forever. And the second thing we would say is, if you are in continual struggles, please, please seek counseling. We have done that in different points of our marriage. I've done that just in specifically in dealing with a couple of our children that have really deep issues. Just seeking someone who can be an outside arbitrator that can listen to both of you and help you get on the same page. So I would highly encourage you to seek outside help. There's no shame in going to counseling. There's no shame. In fact, I think it's pretty cool, and you should shout it from the rooftops that you have the courage to go to counseling.
You got to find a good one. You got to find a good one. You have to vet, and probably if you're here at Reston, you probably have a short list of people you refer to. One of the things that we've been exposed to recently is EFT, emotional focus therapy, and people going through EFT are getting help in months instead of years. Our entire counseling ministry has turned completely over, and they all do EFT now. They don't do any more talk therapy, no more psychobabble. It's EFT. It's understanding where your emotions are generated, when you get mad, when you said those words, when you yell, when you raised, where you feel it in your hands, your throat, your chest, whatever, and then what's that telling you about your reaction to your husband or wife? And we have a Christian couple that comes in, both licensed marriage therapists, and they spend 8 weeks with our mentor group teaching them EFT. And it's so helpful to understand. One woman told the story of when her husband drives, she feels it in her hands. What a metaphor. He drives crazy, and she wants to control. And just understanding that for her began to open up. This is what's going on when my husband drives like a maniac, and why. How many of you argue in the car when you're driving? The one place we may fight today is about directions. Even though we both have the phones.
Or GPS in our car.
But back to the question. Just gin up the courage and say, I'm sorry. I was stupid to say those hurtful words. Will you please forgive me? I need help. I need you to help me. I need Christ's help, not to be angry or overzealous or whatever.
Is EFT, Michael, a program, a book, or can you expand on that just a little?
A very long story short, there's a Christian book that's just come out. Love Sense is a popular book, and Hold Me Tight are popular books, but they're very secular and very pagan. And there's a Christian guy who just produced the new book.
I don't know the name.
If you look up the name Sue Johnson, Hold Me Tight, and do some Googling, you'll find the Christian iteration of that book that just came out. But it's a modality.
And the one Sue Johnson, the two she wrote are really, really good. You just have to, read them with
There's
grain.
Stuff in there you're going to hate. And she's working with same-sex couples and stuff in her book, and so you got to filter through the secular nonsense. But EFT is a modality, just like Gestalt or talk therapy, or it's a new modality. John Bowlby was the father of it, if I remember, and he did work in attachment disorder with children. He died in 1990. Not Christians. I'll be careful in this area. We're not like promoting this. What we're saying is people are getting help, as opposed to seeing a Christian counselor for 2 years and they're still stuck with being a victim of abuse. We're seeing people in a matter of months get really good help and get dislodged from their issue, the cycle that they tend to get in. Unstuck is what our counselor says. His goal is to get you unstuck. So anyway,
how do you know when it's time to go see a counselor versus we can still work this out between us?
I think if you're asking the question, should I go see a counselor, you should go see a counselor. It's so simple. Because you know what? It's not like a counselor should be your last resort. I mean, shoot, you can have a good marriage and go to a counselor and get a tune-up. There's nothing bad about going to a counselor.
It's kind of like a financial planner. You know, we do pretty well with our money. This new set of guys we're talking to have helped us in ways we didn't even know you could do. And, you know, Cindy mentioned she went to see a friend of ours who's a psychologist about our two younger kids. And, you know, we were on very different pages, and I was compartmentalized, and over here they're free agents, and Cindy wasn't there. And she went and saw this woman a couple times and came back, and we talked about it, and back on with life. So it's, you know, tune-up's a good word.
I feel like I'm waging a constant battle against lustful fantasy thinking in my mind. Mm. I've been trying to reprogram my thought life. A lot of times we think that could be guys, but nowadays it could be women as well.
Yeah.
So what would you say to that?
This is the bane of the technology, and this is probably my biggest concern. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, the boastful pride of life. Why is it that the visual images we see don't satisfy? If adultery and pornography satisfied, we would look at it one time, we'd have an affair once, and we'd be satiated. Lust will never satisfy. Lust is insatiable. So as our hearts and souls are pulled toward lust, what we're looking for is a form of intimacy. And again, the neurochemistry bears this out. When the oxytocin levels get so high in pornography, you can't sustain those in normal relationships, and people become dull in their interpersonal relationships. They become dull in their marriage. The help for this, if you can't unplug and disconnect, just walk away from the technology, you're going to need some help. It is an enormous battle. It's insidious right now in the Christian community. I would say,
Michael, what if it's not just about the technology? What if it's just about your thinking even without the technology?
Well, you have to replace it. And lust of the flesh, lust of the mind, both part of life have to be replaced with something else. Think on these things, something good. Robert Morgan is an author that Cindy and I both like. He wrote the Little Red Sea Rules book, and he wrote a book called 100 Verses Every Christian Should Memorize. And I haven't even told Cindy this, but that's one of my goals for 2017, is I'm trying to get these 100 verses memorized. A lot of them I already know. But that is a redirection of my mental energy. You can't just stop. You know, the Bible never says stop sinning. It says turn to do something else. Be a blessing instead, Peter talked about, instead of doing these things in your marriage. Be harmonious. I think accountability is helpful. That good friend to say, hey, man, I'm really struggling. I think about this all the time. I am constantly lusting and I look at another man, look at another woman. And again, the incidence rates of women is growing as well, which is kind of striking. But you need God's Word, God's Spirit, God's people. It's simple. It's reductionistic as I can put the Christian life in every area. If you're not intimately with God's Word, God's Spirit, God's people, you're going to struggle with this all your life. Will you have victory over it? Probably not, but you'll be better at it. And I do think cultivating your intimacy with your spouse is the safety valve that God gives us. A friend of mine taught me years ago when he did conference speaking that he would always plan to have sex with his wife before he left. I thought, that seems kind of unromantic. You know, so you plan Saturday night, we're going to have sex, I leave Sunday morning. But he said, I want to leave with my love tank full when I'm on travel by myself so I'm not tempted. Yeah, it's a different world today you're in. So think as you ought to think, not as you do think. That sound judgment, Romans chapter 12. I would just encourage you, find a really close brother or sister, you know, same sex obviously, not cross sex, and just say, I really struggle with this. Help me. Will you pray with me? Will you encourage me? I would like to expunge this out of my brain. Why is it we remember those visual images and I don't remember the verses I memorized? It tells me something about my sin nature. So I think a lot of it is we're looking for a false intimacy that is insatiable. And if I can begin there intellectually going, this will never satisfy me, as alluring as it is, it's unreal, it's wrong, this fantasy relationship with this person is not what I think it's going to be. Now, Christ, help me recalibrate that. In Phil Yancey's book, What's So Amazing About Grace, if you read that book years ago, he tells a story of a friend of his who got involved in an affair with a woman, and he talked about how she was loving and patient and kind and understanding, and they had great sex, and he explains it in great detail in this book, and he leaves his wife and marries this other woman. And he ran into him in an airport about a year later, and he said the vibrancy and the enthusiasm that he had talked about this young woman was completely gone, and they looked like an old couple sitting on a bench. And it was all, you know, he said, I don't know what you do with that when it comes to showing grace to people that make those decisions, but the illusion that that relationship was going to fulfill something insatiable. Human relationships cannot satiate your longings. Only Christ can. And that's the thin condition, right? That's about the best I can give you, John.
Let me look out here. Any questions real quick? Okay. So here in Northern Virginia, there's often times where we have a little bit of role reversal, where, as you mentioned a little bit, the wife is working longer hours, making more money, the husband's more staying at home. How do you handle that sort of role reversal? Any suggestions on how to handle that role reversal?
I think, one, really be aware of it and talk about it. And just, I mean, talk about the elephant in the room. You know, I work longer hours than you do. I have these things. And I think... One of the things that I've learned a lot in our relationship is that right now, for the most part, I can work longer hours than Michael. Not always, but I'm pulled all the time. We can't go on vacation. I'm always have to be plugged in because I may be even, you know, negotiating a contract somewhere else. It is that no matter what I do, he is still my priority, and I always have him as the person and the relationship that I respect the most. So I have to separate, this is what I do, but this is who I am. Does that make sense? What I do is I'm a real estate agent. What I am is the wife of Michael Easley, and he is my priority. So there's times, honestly, he has to remind me of that. He'll have to go, you know, put your phone down. I'm like, okay. You know, this contract can wait, and it can sometimes. Not always.
Not always.
Sometimes. And when I can, I'll go, honey, I need 10 more minutes.
We were in Israel, and she was working like 3 deals, and we're in Israel for crying out loud. She's on her computer working contracts. I would say keeping a sense of humor, too. And one thing that we've worked very hard against, when I was the primary breadwinner and she was stay-at-home raising children primarily, not working outside in addition, and, you know, I made the money. We paid the mortgage and the insurance and all that came out of my salary. We never used that language. It was our salary. And when Cindy's income started growing, it was our salary.
It's our money.
And that we don't believe in separate checking accounts in that world. It's our money. And she might have closed 2 houses and gotten a handsome amount of money. And the first thing she will say is, we give a lot of money away. And she goes, who do you want to give some money away to? Because I just closed this house. And so it's our money we're discussing. And I think both of you have to take that role and not my job and I'm the primary breadwinner nonsense. That's just pride. It can hurt a man's ego. But and that's where I think Cindy in this case demonstrates it well. If you can be kind and say, honey, God's given me this ability and it's our money. And when it's been very stressful, candidly, she's even said, do you want me to quit real estate? If it's that important to our marriage, I'll stop selling real estate. And so we've had those discussions as well. And that's one of the things we take year to year right now. How much longer are we going to do this? But we don't have kids at home under the roof. We have the flexibility. And the role has changed. She doesn't cook dinner like she did years before. You know, she does still, but not like she used to. And I'm like, that's cool. I'm really okay with that. That was probably harder for you to accept.
Yeah, I felt like I wasn't feeding him. Not taking care. You know, not doing my wifely job. Whatever.
So you said that you transitioned to being empty nesters now, and this is like the best years of marriage. Any advice on those folks who are transitioning to being an empty nester?
I just want to talk to stay-at-home moms for just a second. If you're a stay-at-home mom and you have kids that are in high school and your life does often revolve around them because they're in sports or music or whatever they're doing, And can I say that you need to start taking back some of your life now? Don't wait until they're all in college. You need to, whether it's volunteer work or doing things in your church or getting a part-time job. I'm not saying that your kids are unimportant. I'm just saying that when they're gone, they are gone. They will come home, and you live for when they come home. You live for the holidays. You can't wait to have all your kids under your home again. I still say that, to me, that the picture of security is all of my children in my house asleep with all the doors locked. That's the picture of security to me. Because I just know all my little chicks are safe.
And mine is just the opposite. Everybody's gone. It's just the two of us in our house alone with no mess anywhere.
That's exactly right. But I would say really start planning for empty nest now. Even if your kids are in middle school, start planning now. Find something that is you, that is a piece of yours. Maybe it's a hobby. Maybe you have always wanted to learn to play golf or some other sport, or maybe you've always wanted to take up a certain hobby. Start doing it now. You know, 5-10 hours a week, whatever you can do to start figuring out who you are without being the mother to those children. It's really, really important. I have seen friends who have not fared well in empty nest, who were lonely and bitter and sad and felt like their purpose in life was over because their kids were gone. And I've seen women who have done really, really well. I'll tell you, even as busy as I am and as much work as I do, I mean, there are times that I do miss that, you know, all the kids at the table at 5 or 6 or 7 or 7:30 when we lived here. And just those times of having those kids that I was influencing and enjoying, there are times I still miss that. So I'm really glad I have something else that fulfills me.
We have one of the things I've noticed on social media, we live in SEC country in Nashville, which is a cult, hands down a cult. I mean, people's involvement in college sports is just astonishing. And social media is very telling. And when back 100 years ago, when Mike and I were pastors 20, 30 years ago, people came to church 3 out of 4 Sundays. I remember when it got to about 2.5 when we lived here in Northern Virginia. It's about 1.2 in Nashville right now. People come to church. Because one of the trends you're seeing is as our age group, let's say a little younger than us, as their kids are in college now, what do those parents do on college game weekends? They go to their child's school. And you see it on their Facebook feed. They're going down to UT, they're going to Georgia, they're going to Ole Miss, Alabama, they're going to all these SEC games. And I see these great family pictures of their freshman, sophomore, junior, senior kid in college. Now, I'm not against that. I'm not dissing. I'm just observing this is more important to them than the life of the local church. Why? Because their kids aren't in the local church anymore. Their kids are gone. And it's just an interesting social picture to look at how trends change. And the church is a fractured entity. So tandem with what Cindy says, I'm not against anybody going to see their kid's sport or their kid's college or, you know, the parents there weekend, whatever. But you got to ask the question, is your life simply being that child's mother and or father? And that's where I like the word free agency. They're free agents. I love being with them. I love hanging with them. But I'm not primarily responsible for them anymore. Praise Jesus. They're on their own, baby, and that's the way God intended it, that they leave their father and their mother and become one flesh.
And because of that, it's also really important that no matter what the age of your children, you are dating each other. You're spending time together. You're developing your own couple's culture, so to speak, that you're hanging out with other friends, going out to dinner with friends, so that all of a sudden your kids are in college and you realize there's a void, a chasm between you because you don't know this person anymore. So that's really, really important, just that you find things to do together, even if it's just going out to dinner once a week and visiting and getting to know each other, staying in tune with the other person.
So when you're newly married, how do you know you're ready to have kids?
I don't know. Are you ever ready to have kids? Those of you with kids, I mean, you think you are. You're great. Really, how many of us were perfect parents until we had children? Right? Right? We know what everybody's doing wrong, and we would not do it the same way, and if they just did it like the way we're going to parent our kids would all be great. Yeah, whatever. So then God gives you two or three kids, and you go, I don't know, I have any idea what I'm talking about. So I don't know that you're ever ready. I mean,
a friend of mine told me, take a garden rake and go out to your garage and run it down both sides of your cars as many times as possible, and then you're ready to have kids.
So the bottom line is, I don't know that you are. I think you should both be on the same page about it, that, you know, you're both like, okay. I mean, one of you may be the gung-ho, and the other one may be, well, okay, if we have to have children, I guess this is the time to start. But, you know, which was how it was true, and I was ready to have babies, and he was like, well, all right, I guess if we have to. I'm like, yeah, we do. And
Cindy had a wonderful plan for my life.
Yeah, but so, yeah, just do it. And then you'll be looking at this little creature going, aren't they the most amazing thing you've ever seen? And you literally, you go, what did we do for fun before we could stare at this thing asleep?
It's interesting in Nashville culture right now because a lot of them are waiting. I don't know, it's maybe true here too, but they're starting kids in the mid-30s. They're waiting a long time to have kids, and you're seeing infertility issues more so than before. In fact, we went through infertility, but that's a different story. But I don't know. I have a number of friends who are OBGYNs, and they as I talk to them about what they're dealing with, it's more complicated the older you become. And you know this intellectually, but not to put pressure on you. But when they do have children, they become insufferable parents. And when I see them in the hallway, whatever, I go, what'd you do before you had that little Micah? And they go, we don't know. I mean, they're just insufferable, the happiest people on the planet. So it is a joyful thing, and I think it is part of the mandate for us to create, to have children. You don't have to. I don't think it's God telling you must, but I think a marriage does involve children, generally speaking, not always. And then you start learning a lot about your marriage, too, to becoming one. But that was God's design. That's why you're sitting here.
Someone once said that God gives us children as our last chance to grow up, and that's really true.
Michael and Cindy, thank you very much. Can we have a round of applause for them?
Can you put that image up? Did you capture that image? I just want to show you, if you have any interest in the In Context site, everything on here is free. There is the resource there for the Marriage Mentor Group. It's a PDF you can download. It's about 10 megs, so I can't send it through email easily, but you can download it. And it's the paint by numbers, what we do for our 2-year program. And if you're leading a group or in a group, just rip it off and use part of it. Just take a look at it. See if it would help you. And the reading list is also on there with a bunch of different resources. And if you're bored, there's hundreds of podcasts on there interviewing all kinds of people, for everything about marriage and life and race relations and same-sex marriage and all kinds of hopefully helpful information. Thanks.
Thank you very much.